part of writing is like it's a dialectic. Even if you do write really didactically, which just means like a teacher, you're telling them what to think. Even if you do that, they're still going to interpret and respond to it. So you can't really control the entirety of how they interpret the piece. And one of the great things about theme is that you can use it as like an intentional dialectic.
Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real made-up things. I'm your host, Red. With me are Kathy and Sam, and joining us is Benji of Tale Foundry. This week, we'll be discussing story themes, but first, why don't you all give our audience a digital wave hello and introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Kathy, the overprepared GM. I'm a writer with World Building Magazine and a huge fan of everything science fiction and fantasy related. Sam?
Hello, I'm Sam. I am a student, and in my spare time, I help the magazine with art and editing the podcast.
Hey, I'm Benji. I spend most of my career pretending to be a robot over on the YouTube channel Tale Foundry, just talking about a lot of fiction, finding stories we love, and stealing ideas from them to write our own things. Apart from that, I write. I enjoy talking about this stuff, which is why I'm here. Thank you guys for having me.
I'm glad to have you here, Benji. I'm a longtime fan of the live stream that you put on weekly. I've participated in it myself quite a few times. If you guys haven't ever checked that out, it's definitely worth checking out. He does that over on Twitch as well. There's plenty of time for plugging at the end of the episode. So let's just go ahead and move in to the meat of the topic here a little bit. Benji, I'm actually going to let you take this away for a moment if you want. We're going to do something a little different this time around. I want to ask the question, what are themes? But what are your thoughts on that? Why did you want to talk themes?
It's a really interesting subject because I think theme is one of those words that gets thrown around so much that it's kind of become next to meaningless. Like, people have this idea of what they mean when they refer to theme, especially in like a story. But when pressed, it's like, well, theme is, you know, the message of the story, but it's also like the connection between the characters and the plot, and it's the correlation between the plot points, and it's all these things. And vaguely, there's this understanding that theme is like, it's the important stuff in the story. It's that abstract messaging in the piece. And so you hear like, you know, the showrunners behind Game of Thrones classically said something like theme is something for an eighth grade composition class or something like that. And you see how well it went for them in the last couple seasons of Game of Thrones. So it's obviously a really important thing, but then it's also something we don't tend to understand very well. And I have a lot of thoughts about what theme might be, but really I think there's kind of two ways to think about this. On the one hand, theme is argumentative. You look at the history of the word, it comes from the Latin, I think it's thema, I'll say it in my standard American dialect. You see that, and that means like something written down in words, an argument, a statement, it's the thesis of an argument. Then you look at this more generalized idea of theme, and it's much more akin to like web design, where you have a bunch of components in a page, and somehow these components come together to make an impression for that page. So you'll go on WordPress and you'll find like these theme packages that have a bunch of pre-designed layouts for your navigation, and they'll have aesthetics and color patterns and things like that, so you don't have to think through it yourself. And looking through each of them, they're named, they very distinctly exhibit a character for the page. So I think those are the two main ways of thinking of theme, as a thesis, as the argument behind the whole thing, and as sort of the connective tissue of the whole thing. I think we'll get into like why those are, you know, worthwhile thinking about going into, and not just abstract academic things to look at. But to me, I think one of the most important things we can do in this episode, and hopefully, you know, we will get around to, is kind of cultivating an understanding of what this weird nebulous thing is. I think one of my favorite takes on this was Stephen King in On Writing. He was talking about like writing classes and writing groups and the kind of feedback you can generally expect in like a, you know, an introductory creative writing class, and everyone will just be like, mm-hmm. Oh, I really like the theme of this piece. And it illustrates like, you know, it's just a go-to for like, there's something meaningful in there, but what is it? And that's kind of my impression of this topic from the outset.
And I've always felt that way. Nebulous is a great word to describe what I think the general understanding of it is. I took a lot of critical theory courses, literary theory courses, and that's another word that gets tossed around a lot. And it's kind of interesting, though, because you almost never talk about it in a writing course, at least where I was taught. So, yeah, it constantly comes off as this kind of lofty and nebulous thing that I hope that, yeah, like Benji said, by the end of the episode, we can help you guys understand a little bit better.
I think that from a world building point of view in particular, it's very easy to fall into the trap of feeling like if you want to build a complete world, then you need to be comprehensive in your approach to it. If you want it to be realistic, if you want it to be believable, then you have to really think through all these different topics. And the problem with that is that you can't. Every single world is too large to mm-hmm. possibly get into everything that you could get into. And so what everyone does, even historians, when they're dealing with the actual real world that already exists, need to figure out what it is they're focusing on. What is it that we can use to make a cohesive storyline? What is it that are the important parts of the history or the important parts of the world building that we want to focus on? And that is the theme, I would say, in the literary sense of what are the topics that are crucial to really focus on in this narrative. And I think that on the other side, the aesthetic side of themes that was brought up earlier, we need to do that not just for us as creators, but for the audience. If you have this aesthetic sense that is too disjointed and has too many different things and nothing really bringing it together to form one cohesive experience, then no one's going to be able to remember it. Mm. You know, no one remembers a 400-page history, but if you can sum it up in a sentence or two, then that'll be a world that makes an impact on the audience's memory.
I think themes are sort of, what does the reader think about, or what does the author think about, or what's being explored in general? It's hard to say exactly, but it's not really so much how you're reading it, but like it's sort of fundamentally what the story is trying to say, or what it's thinking about, or just how you are saying and what you are thinking about the world it's in.
Well, I was just going to go back to something that Benji was saying, as well as what Sam just said, which has to do with this idea of exploring in a central theme and having a thesis. It's useful to differentiate those two ideas. Your theme might be identity, right? Whereas your thesis might be a particular point of view on it. And so does that make sense?
Yeah. There's something about what Sam was saying that I find really interesting, this differentiation between the authorial intent and like the audience's interpretation. Mm-hmm. With theme, it's really tricky because you kind of have to balance those things. You might be thinking a lot like, well, what is the audience going to take away? And like, what do I want them to take away? But one of the tricky things is that part of writing is like, it's a dialectic. Even if you do write really didactically, which just means like a teacher, you're telling them what to think. Even if you do that, they're still going to interpret and respond to it. So you can't really control mm-hmm. the entirety of how they interpret the piece. And one of the great things about theme is that you can use it as like an intentional dialectic where you present all the elements of it, you connect them, maybe you even tell the audience how you see the connection. But the theme, as an emergent like quality of all these different things you chose to put into your world or your story, will present differently to the audience. So instead of like solely relying on some mission statement or something like that, they have the same components there that you drew your theme or your thesis from, and they can have their own take on it, you know, without having to rely or respond to that explicit guidance you've given them as an author.
And I think that some of the best explorations of themes, and this is why when if you try to just Google literary themes, you're literally going to see it broken down into like one or two words. You almost never see it with its own message put baked into the theme itself. It's usually just something like love, war, and peace, you know, stuff like that. Some of the best explorations of theme happen on both sides of that fence. They kind of give you both viewpoints and say, this is the thing I'm talking about. This is the ways that people can look at it. And what viewpoint on that you kind of jive with is kind of up to you. And I find that true even of the more aesthetic bits too that that you brought up before, Benji. Even for the aesthetic points, that kind of comes off that way. That's why one of the more interesting examples of this, which is Princess Mononoke, works so well here, even though Miyazaki did not want that movie to work well here. In fact, the movie he said was supposed to be kind of a criticism of how the U.S. handles, you know, the political sphere outside their own realm, how they operate with the world in warfare and peace and stuff like that. Instead, you have a lot of people here who really dig it because it still sends a really good message about the themes that it's presenting, much to his chagrin. And sometimes that separation of author is just going to happen inevitably, but that is the cool thing about theme, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely a thing. And also that different people, even the audience, can have very different ideas, such as with an example that potentially touches on something I'm interested in. There's an ancient Irish story called The Time of Culinar, and the protagonist in it, who some of you may know as Cuchulainn, in the original, it's quite clearly, or at least in my opinion, it's quite clearly written as an anti-war epic, saying that Cuchulainn, as the product of his violent society, is definitely not an aspirational figure. However, throughout like recent history with Irish political movement, he has been framed on both sides of the unionist nationalist debate as an aspirational hero, to my memory. I may be wrong about that. But it's interesting that people are taking this hero who is definitely flawed and who academia, I think, in my experience, interprets as not an aspirational character, but more as a symptom of the flaws of his society, and they turn him into this aspirational culture hero. And for two completely different goals, which I think is an interesting understanding of how themes change over time and from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think globally the world's kind of done that with Beowulf, for instance. And, you know, you could say that there's a lot lost in translation, quite literally, from the amount of times that monks had taken that story and turned it into something it wasn't originally. You got this, for lack of a better way to put it, meathead of a hero in that story, and you kind of start to see perils of what, you know, just constantly going into battle can do. He creates his own monster by, you know, by killing Grendel and ending up having to face Grendel's mother, right? And so you kind of get that in some of the, again, in the better stories. I feel like these ones that stick with people that are memorable kind of tackle things from both sides. And that's the interesting thing about being an audience member to some of this stuff.
There's kind of an interesting aspect of theme in that, like, you know, it's not all explicit. It's not all mm-hmm. something the author baked into the story. You put a bunch of stuff into a pot and elements of all of those things are bound to share something in common. You're bound to get some kind of, you know, emergent flavor, right? And whether that's mm-hmm. A good or a bad thing is just a result of the, I guess, extending this metaphor, the cook. So you can have a story that you put together, like you were saying, Princess Mononoke, that different people are able to find different connection points on, different points of the Venn diagram that the author didn't even bother to look at or couldn't see at the time. And the interesting thing is, like, those connective points can be objectively present or subjectively mm-hmm. present. You can say, right. well, all these characters are men, and that can be objectively true, and that can create a theme. Or also you can say, all of these characters are evil, and that's a subjective judgment, but it also creates mm-hmm. a theme. And
creates a theme,
the yeah. interesting difference between this is those objective elements, everyone will see them, and everyone can say they are there, and then we go and interpret what that means for theme. But with the subjective elements, we see them and we say either, well, they aren't there and it doesn't create a theme at all, or I agree, I see that, and that creates a theme. And this is something I see very often with, like, movies, for instance. People will be doing critiques of movies on YouTube, and they'll say, oh, I thought all the men in this movie were sexist or something like that. Well, it's a typical kind of critique you'd see of a modern film. And they'll go into that, but then people in the comments will be saying, like, well, you're totally off the mark that none of them even are that way in this film. I don't have any particularly good examples, but I just think it's so interesting how, like, we tend to think of theme as this thing that the author tries to put in the story, but it can emerge at so many different points and be such a different thing for so many different people. And there's a note in here, I don't know who put it in, but it's a question about, like, multiple themes in a story. And, you know, I didn't write any notes about this, but I'm just, as we talk, I'm thinking about it, and it's weird. You know, as an author, it's really something you can't control.
I think that when you have a story, like, you don't just have to stick to one. You can have like, lots of things you're tackling, or, like, depending on your size, of course. So, like, The Count of Monte Cristo, I don't know if any of you read it, but it's a brilliant story, and it has sort of a theme of revenge as its overarching theme, but it also has themes of sort of infidelity and themes of, like, faithfulness and of sort of love, and it's all wrapped up in many of them serve the wider theme of revenge, but in a sense they're also these sort of other themes that one can view through certain characters, and one can look at that as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you know what, I think I do have an example. You got me thinking about this, and maybe Tolkien is a good example, because or C.S. Lewis, but something you run into a lot is people looking at the author intent and kind of validating only those themes, only the ones that connect to an evidenced author intent. Mm-hmm. Whereas there are so many reads of the story, and people will find themes and they'll kind of be rejected because, well, that's not what the author meant by the story. So it can't be what mm-hmm. it's about. But it's like, well, yeah, but if you look, I mean, these elements are there and they do, like, share this in common. Maybe he didn't mean anything with it, but it is the case. You know, that pattern is there in the story.
I think that this worldview where the author owns the story, and it really comes out of this idea of copyright. We want to promote creativity and all this stuff, and individualism in a lot of ways, but it's a bit of a historical anomaly. If you go back to ancient times and classical times, medieval times, there was a lot more of an assumption that stories that you got from tradition, and that, you know, from your elders and from people before, that those stories are the legitimate ones, and something that someone just makes up is less legitimate. And so you'll see a lot of stories that are written by people who don't claim authorship and instead put authorship onto some legendary figure or historical figure in the past in order to make their stories feel more legitimate. And mm-hmm. they just claim that they're retelling them. And nowadays, I feel like there's a sort of backlash against the people who are doing this telling and retelling with in the movies and books, especially, where, you know, you're looking down on fan fiction or you're looking down on remakes as being this evidence of a dearth of creativity, Whereas I feel like, you know, if you're taking a story and you're saying something new with it, if you're saying it from your point of view, if you're retelling it, it's part of this tradition that we have in a lot of the world, in a lot of places, and through most of time, that I think is very core to the human experience and the core to what we like to do as creators. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But what changes usually is not the details of character and plot, but the themes that you're using, both in terms of aesthetic and in terms of topic, to tell through the story.
Well, I mean, yeah, especially just look at all the people who have done their own takes on Arthurian legend, which in and of itself is also a retelling of older myths too. You get a lot of different takes on those, and that produces sort of different messages every time. And while more or less most of your core players kind of stay in place, you still get some of this transition of people saying, well, what if Morgana is, Arthur's sister? How does that change things? And you get this kind of play that lets you see some of the same themes used slightly differently and allow people to extrapolate their own thing from that. Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just going to... Though, even in Arthuriana, you can see a massive shift in the tones. So from... Or the theme. So in things like... In the original things like Cilac ag Olwen, which is one of the earliest Arthurian stories we have, it's a comedy about King Arthur and his court helping a boy win his lover. It's a comedy. It's very light, and it's sort of about its sort of theme is, I wouldn't say it's non-existent, but its purpose is more as a satire to joke about and parody the courtly tales. But then later, you get other stories like you get Le Morte d'Arthur, which is more serious. I haven't read it, but that's the impression I got. Sorry if I'm wrong. And then into the modern period, you have things like reinterpretations, and you have themes in Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain, which is more of a criticism of that sort of Camelot Arthurian
style. Or Miss of Avalon, which is feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. There's so many different takes on Arthuriana now. One of my favourites is Here Lies Arthur by Philip Reeve, which is, its theme is sort of about like the fallibility and of monarchy and the power of stories is a big one, because its ending, hopefully, a slight spoiler for Here Lies Arthur, is that the ending of the book is a character going off after the Battle of Camlann to tell these stories about King Arthur, having learnt the stories, and sort of, it's sort of set in a pseudo-historical past, and the story ends saying, so I went on, and maybe I embellished bits about him, and we told our stories to get by, and yeah, it just ends with this girl going off and telling stories, and it's an interesting thing about the theme of stories, which I think is an interesting, almost a meta theme, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, then we get to... Oh, I was going to say, we get to Monty Python and we come full circle. Now it's a comedic satire again.
Yeah. I think the medieval Welsh would have quite enjoyed Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
So we've kind of covered the ground then, definitely, of what we think theme kind of is. But so... I want to kind of make sure that we tread the ground more too on why it is that we should care about theme. I get that we can use it kind of as a moral to our story, or we can kind of use it as more of an aesthetic thing too. But if I'm about to go about writing something or world building something, should I be caring about theme? Should I be trying to look at what I want to tackle, or is that something I should allow to come out organically?
I have a story about this. It's pretty short. There's a book called Story by Robert McKee, and this is kind of like the film writing Bible for a lot of people. They discover it in some of their first few classes about writing for cinema and script. And one of the things he talks about in there, pretty authoritatively is this idea of a controlling idea. And I think the way he expresses this is ending value plus cause, which is kind of a pretentious way of saying, like, where does the story end up and how do you get there? And the idea behind it is if you can figure that out at the top of designing your story and plotting it and whatever, it can inform what you put into the story so that you have a cohesive whole. And in theory, it sounds pretty good. It's like you want to know where you're going and how to get there. But what I actually find in practice, what I found trying to follow this, is that half the joy of writing is that creative process. Maybe 90% of the joy of writing is that creative process. Spending the time drafting the thing out, exploring it. Like the drafting process, I almost say it's not writing because it's not as painful when you can let go. It's not like I'm sitting here writing for an audience. It's more like I'm, you know, just spinning a flax and like making thread to spin something out of later, right? And so during that process, you discover so much about your piece. You're like getting to know the idea for the first time by committing things to the page. Then once you're done with your first draft, you can look back and see what you've made and what emerged in the process. And I think that is really where you get a handle on theme and what the story really looks like and what you want to do with it. And it's different for everyone, of course, but the problem for me with the whole controlling idea and with deciding themes in advance is that you can end up misidentifying your piece. You can end up thinking it's going to be one thing, but maybe it's your lived experience, maybe it's your personal style. Something is going to affect that piece during the writing, and if you're not open and receptive to it, I feel like you're not going to develop a strong emergent theme. You're going to coerce your story into a predicted theme. And so this is one of the ways being aware of what theme is can be really useful. Being aware of the fact that it is like an emergent thing in some ways that comes out of the overlap of the elements that are in the story rather than something you decide preemptively and then, you know, select before you ever start writing the story. Although I do think, I mean, part of my writing process is to have a vague concept of a theme, like a vague ballpark of stuff I want to put into my story. It's just that it's loose. I have not committed at that point. So that's kind of, you asked like how it's useful. That's kind of one of the dangers of theme. So I kind of gave you the complete opposite, but I still think it's useful to start with.
Right, right. Well, there's again, just like we were saying before, there's nothing wrong with giving both sides of that coin, though. Because I think, and kids, get your bingo cards out because this is Red Soapbox coming up here. I think it comes to knowing the medium that you're writing for. I mentioned this at least once an episode, hence the bingo card joke. But knowing your medium, I think, will help you determine whether or not you really need to be thinking about it beforehand too. When you're writing a piece of fiction to be read, it's largely different than trying to produce a movie, which is kind of a bit more of a snapshot. You only have a limited amount of time and space to work within. I think one of the guys who does this phenomenally is Christopher Nolan. That man is a freaking wizard. If you aren't aware, pretty much every movie he has made, with the exception of some, you know, like the Batman movies, things that he's kind of done off on the sides of his normal work, has some plays with time to some degree. Most of the time, this is kind of an aesthetic thing, but it works really well for a film, right? So I think it can provide this sort of clarity for what it is that you're wanting to achieve when you have your medium in mind. Christopher Nolan probably sits down, and I'm not going to presume to know what he thinks when he sits down, but I think that he thinks when he sits down, you know, this is the thing I want to play with. In Memento, it was what would happen if I told the story backwards, basically. For Prestige, it was what if I have three different time periods that are all informing each other happening at the same time. You have Interstellar, which is what if time travel were possible, spoiler alert, but if you haven't seen it, what are you doing? Inception, it's kind of just time dilation there. It's very aesthetic. You end up with, finally here at the end, we end up with Tenet, where it's like we can play with time going forwards and backwards at the same time. And I think each one of those helps him produce this narrative that is very cohesive, in the sense that he had this picture in mind from the very get-go about what kind of story he wanted to tell and who needed to be the main players in it, and how that's supposed to unfold when he knows that time is the theme he's exploring in there.
I think that, going back to your original question about whether it's a good thing and should we be doing it purposefully, I hear what Benji was saying. I would qualify that with anything in the creative process. You have to be willing to let go your darlings. You know, kill your darlings, let them go. If it isn't working, get rid of it. But that said, I think there's probably two main approaches to theming. One is the inspiration approach, where it's part of the things that inspires you. You are looking to explore a particular topic, and you haven't decided your thesis yet. That will be evolving in the course of the creation. But you know that that's something that's driving this particular creation. And then the other approach is more of an editing process, where you've gotten all the stuff together, and now you're trying to figure out what to keep and what to throw, what goes in and what needs to be changed in order to make it flow together better. And so from a sort of very practical point of view, you can look at theming in those two directions. But I think it's not a matter of whether or not to put themes in your work. The theme's going to be there. It's just a matter of whether or not you're going to be aware of it and in control of it.
Right.
Yeah. I think theme is interesting, and it's, I keep using this word, but it's emergent quality, because I agree with you. I think it is very, I think it's very short-sighted of me to be like, oh, you can't predict what your story is going to be about. I mean, I think you can. I think it was a long way of saying exactly what you said. You're going to, you know, benefit from letting go of your darlings if you can most of the time, when they aren't working out, right? But, Well, you know what? Yeah, cut this. I decided I don't know where I'm going with it.
No, I think that was a good point, though.
I was just reiterating it.
But I think I also...
with backing up Kathy.
But I also agree with what you said, in the sense that, and I think most people have gotten to a work where they've read it, and it's clear the author had something to say, and man, they are just shoving it down your throat, whatever it is, you know? And that's sort of the bad side of theming, where they have decided what they want to tell you, and instead of taking a sentence to say it to you or exploring it in a really complex and subtle way, they're just going to hammer it right in, and that's painful. So,
well, and it lacks understanding, both for the author and for the audience. You need to be able to breed both sides of that equation, like I said before. I think one of the best examples of this is the theme of growing up in Narnia. Mm-hmm. I feel like C.S. Lewis, I feel like there are weirdly opinions on the idea of growing up. You have people who are adults who think that everyone needs to learn how to become a little bit more serious with life, learn how to adult. Whereas there is something to be said, though, about maintaining some of that youthfulness and that creativity that we have as children. And that's the interesting thing about Narnia, is that C.S. Lewis kind of points out both sides of that in several different places. You have in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you've got one of these siblings who is quite frankly a complete and total tool to all of his siblings. And he, in his own way, needs to learn to grow up, to take accountability for his actions, and to understand what a family means to him. That requires him to grow up. But later on in the series, we've also got another one of the siblings who does, in a more classical sense, grow up and becomes more enamored with adult things, with makeup and stuff like that. And that causes her to fall away from being able to ever go back to Narnia. And so it's very interesting to see sort of these dichotomies in the same realm that I don't think you quite see as often as you probably should with themes, is being able to explore both sides of one coin and saying there are some positive aspects to this, there are some negative aspects to it, and allowing your audience to glean from that what is going to be most useful and practical to them learning from it.
I think that's one of the funnest parts of theme that separates it from just, you know, essay writing or whatever. You can use a story to indicate something and point something out. And because you're doing that, you can create kind of an interesting conversation between multiple points of the theme. I would say in Narnia that these different characters exploring different morals or ideas or paths are actually part of the same theme. They're just making different arguments about it. And that's exactly. That's one of the things we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, that theme is not necessarily the same thing as thesis. It's not necessarily having a point of view and sharing it. Theme is putting all of the materials together that create the conversation around the topic so that people can, you know, engage in it in some fashion. I feel like that's what we do with theme as writers. There's kind of a tangential take on this that I really like. It's not necessarily theme, but I think it connects. Northrop Frye, he's this like well-known critic or whatever. I don't actually know what his occupation is, but he writes a lot of like egghead, fancy lit theory stuff. And he was talking about allegory in his book, The Anatomy of Criticism. And he uses the term naive allegory to describe like morality plays and such, where they kind of defeat themselves as allegories because the story has no substance without the metaphor, where an allegory is supposed to be a metaphor or a message cloaked in story. So the story itself, you know, needs to be sort of substantive on its own to have that effect. Otherwise, you're doing in the form of a story what you could do in a direct sentence, right? So that's what he calls a naive allegory. And I think this is an interesting way to think of theme as well, because if you don't have a substantive story or if the elements of the theme aren't substantive unto themselves, you end up with like a bunch of weird things that you chose to include in the story just for the sake of the theme. And this was the thing I was running into with that controlling idea thing earlier. I would pre-decide what was going into my story, and then eventually I would start like including stuff that was informed by this kind of pretentious idea of what I wanted to convey, rather than what was natural for the piece, what emerged as I was writing and got to know the thing. So that's kind of my take on like what a strong theme might be versus a weak theme. A strong theme being one that has a bunch of self-sufficient elements that are interesting or substantive unto themselves, whereas a weak one might be very self-serving, where it's stuff included just for the sake of what the author meant to convey. I would think of maybe like Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and Crimes of Grindelwald, especially Crimes of Grindelwald, as examples of that kind of like water-thin theme where there's like there's so much in Crimes of Grindelwald especially that you know Rowling just included to make a point about her setting or to make some like political statement or something like that. Or in the case of Grindelwald, maybe to avoid making a political statement. But like, it's rough because if you had just done what was like natural for the story or maybe what logically followed for the characters or something, a theme would emerge and you could tailor that out for the piece. But kind of trying to like preemptively engineer the thing, you just see it in the final product. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my interpretation watching the movie.
Well, I think there is an inherent danger to trying to have that in mind from the get-go, because it often does come off, like Kathy mentioned before, very heavy-handed, like someone's trying to shove something down your throat. The whole point of a theme is largely to be digestible, right?
I think it's really interesting the word you used, Benji, pretentious, because for a lot of people, anything involved with literary theory, literary criticism, certainly inserting themes into anything that you create, there is that air of it's got to be serious or I will be pretentious if I do it. And it doesn't feel sort of down to earth, fun, genre, all these, you know, pop culture things that we're used to that can really be approachable. It's the opposite of that. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that a perfect example that comes to my mind is this series of books called Hive Mind by Janet Edwards. And they are teen dystopias that came right after sort of the glut of teen dystopias that came out. So it was, you know, the Hunger Games and...
Aren't they still coming out?
There's, well, then this one probably...
Oh, I talking about the big ones, like the big ones.
Okay. Yeah, the big ones came out for a while. Yeah. And then this one came out like 2016, 2017, they started. And I read it because I am a book slut. I will read pretty much anything. And at first, it felt very much like all the rest of them. Like, oh, this is another dystopia, and she's totally buying it. And I could see where it was going. And I'm 3-4 books in, whatever it is now. And I still don't know if it's a utopia or dystopia, because she's not taking a firm stance. She didn't have like a clear, you know, here's my theme on the... whatever, you know, I'm going to hammer it into you. She's just exploring this world that has hallmarks of what we associate with utopias and with dystopias. And it's not so straightforward. And it's very much a teen young adult book. It doesn't get super heavy and it's fun, but I still don't know which way she's going to go with it. So I think it can be fun to have it be something that you explore and not fall into the trap of going towards the pretentious.
Yeah. So for me, the answer for a series that does great theming and is still hilarious and fun is Discworld, where that series has so much complex theming around ideas of existentialism, around social justice, around the nature of stories themselves, and it still manages to do it by being absolutely hilarious, and sort of like you're just going along laughing at the gags, and then you realise, oh, that's what it's talking about, and your mind is just, your mindset's racing after that. Yeah, at least that's my experience of them.
That's like the best example ever of this thing I was talking about with, like, you know, the kind of pretentious intended theme versus the kind of emergent one. Like, I don't think it's always pretentious to have a theme in mind, but I think the way you address it is what's going to matter the most to the audience in the end. And like, if you have these elements of the story that are enjoyable and immersive and like serve other things outside of theme unto themselves and feel like they're worth experiencing, then by the time you come to the theme, you've already had a great experience, and then you have a realization and you go, oh, these things connect, and you feel like this sense of completion as if you've put together the pieces of a puzzle. So it's exactly like that, where like you'll just be watching, you know, Sam Vimes, the captain of the guard, be downtrodden in Ankh-Morpork and not have the funding, whatever. And then by the end of the story, like his kind of foibles trying to make things work on the budget that he doesn't have for the guard, you kind of realize it's commentary on social systems and things. And eventually it becomes one on like income equality and stuff. And it's just fabulous that at no point in the story, you know, Pratchett inserts a token of some kind to be like, by the way, make sure you know that this is the theme of the story. You're just there with the characters experiencing the story, and then you get it by the end.
And theme doesn't even need to always be heavy. The best part, in my opinion, of Discworld is the fact that it is a satire about fantasy as a genre as well. It points out all the ridiculous things that people were doing at the time, and frankly, quite a few people are still doing with the genre that you're like, holy moly. You're like, the fact that I find this funny is also kind of sad. Some of the tropes that he uses in there. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Sam, but...
I was just going to say, yeah, that is exact... I think part of it is that he lulls you in with it being funny and it being a satire, and then he hits you with the real social commentary. I think the thing that really, the point it really got to me was Thud, where I was being like, oh, this is quite a cool mystery. And then suddenly I went, oh, it's about racial injustice. And that sort of flipped my whole ideas on the story and made it so much more interesting to me. I think, I think Discworld managed to do it by being, like, as it says, a world and a mirror of worlds, or an amazing fantasy series and a parody of fantasy, and a mirror of fantasy series that exposes what they, their weaknesses by doing it better. I'm a big Discworld fan. Sorry.
Same. This neither here nor there. But I just want to throw this out. I was reading A Slip of the Keyboard, his nonfiction essays, and there's this phrase he used to describe conventional fantasy. I don't know that I necessarily agree with this entirely. I just thought it was amazing. He called it fantasy. Or he called it Tolkien frozen and reheated, which I think is gorgeous.
Very, very true. But, like, he even points out, too, all the funny things that people had been doing with the genre at the time, too, with, like, you know, Conan the Barbarian and stuff like that, where they were kind of, or, I mean, heck, people are still doing it with, you know, bikini armor, let's just call it. He even points some of that out in The Color of Magic, even, and you're like, holy moly, if he's pointing out this trope 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago now, you're like, holy cow.
But, like,
there's some things we need to learn to move away from.
And I do think Discworld has had such an impact on fantasy that's sort of understated. Like, I wasn't surprised that Brandon Sanderson likes Discworld. At least I'm pretty sure I remember him saying he does. Because it's very clear that, like, the lessons that Pratchett was talking about and, like, saying, and, like, shining a mirror up to the dirty parts of fantasy, like, not dirty, but the ugly parts of fantasy, like, I can see that in more modern points, people are looking at that. Maybe because they, if Discworld, maybe just because of that, how society is changing. But people have been moving away from those tropes, and I think that's also a good thing for themes. And how I do have this may be a controversial take, but I do think there was a period where where the same themes were being used over and over again with slight variations. But then, sort of, I think beginning in the 90s and going on, there's been such an explosion of ideas and themes and sort of people who aren't afraid to explore themes or aren't afraid to take a theme that's typically explored elsewhere and then stick it into fantasy. I think that's interesting.
Well, I think, too, this is a classic example of why even a lighthearted theme is okay, too, because I feel like a lot of people who are writing the newer stuff these days at least are aware of Discworld, right? And again, the whole satirization of fantasy as a genre for that, I'm sure is largely played up mostly for laughs, but has for, you know, on its own kind of created now, though, a desire for authors to do something new with it, something that fits a little bit better or is a little bit more unique. So theme doesn't always need to be lofty or, you know, existential even. You can still have some fun with it and people will run with it in their own way.
This conversation, it was making me think of simple themes and very often cartoon shows, you know, that they have like a 10-minute runtime or something classically. Mm-hmm. And they'll have to find a very digestible theme in a short period of time. And often earlier cartoon shows or simpler cartoon shows would have a very, very simple theme because, like, you know, how do you do much else in that time period, especially shows for kids? So you'd see, like, you'd watch an episode of, I don't know, Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends or Ed, Edd n Eddy, Powerpuff Girls, whatever, these Cartoon Network shows, and even SpongeBob, they would have some message you arrive at the end about friendship or independence or something like that, and a character would figure it out. But then you have shows like Steven Universe, where, like, you don't even know what the theme is. It's not, like, explicit sometimes. It's, like, this slow build that by, like, the end of a season, you finally get what all these components are pointing to. And so they'll have, like, these filler episodes that have some, you know, short, canny theme. Like, you know, he spends an episode trying to get his fingers not to be cats anymore and exploring his powers or whatever. And that's cute. And that's a very finite theme. But, like, it builds into the theme of the rest of the series. So people are figuring out how to take these smaller, simpler themes and, like, explore them, even in a medium like cartoon show. So I really feel like this is something that is, I guess, is developing for a lot of different mediums at the same time. Like, I look back at the cartoon shows of my youth, and there was hardly a theme to be seen, like of my youth, like Tom and Jerry and stuff. You know, it was entertainment, right? But now they're getting to be more, for lack of a better term, like authorial. People are trying to put more meaning into them. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is not just because, like, that's a cool emergent thing, but it's also, let me see if I can marshal my thoughts here. It's also kind of an annoying thing I see in movies, this push for theme, because you'll see like a romance arc for no reason. And you'll be like, well, what is this? What is this in the movie for? What is this accomplishing? And I think it's kind of people grasping at a theme, saying like, oh, we have an action movie and there's a bunch of things happening. What's the meaning? What's the purpose of this? And so they'll put this kind of false romance note so the characters have something to develop around so that it feels like there's some kind of identity and so that they can dip into that theme pool. And that, I feel like, is probably like the worst side of this, like reaching for a theme. This idea that if you can just get a theme in there, it'll elevate the piece. And so do it some way. Make it, you know, in an anime, make it the power of friendship, or in a Disney film, the power of love, or, you know.
Well, and I feel like this is where the 100 struggles. I've never read the books that they're based on, and after having watched a fair chunk of the show, I don't know that I want to read the books. But, like, that whole, like, idea of trying to, like, sandwich a theme in where you can kind of thing, I feel like is why I really detest that show now. I feel like in the first season, actually, for a show from the CW focused around teens, which, in my opinion, are 9 times out of 10 going to turn into garbage, especially the CW, bless their hearts for trying. But it was an engrossing show for that first season. But then as the seasons go on, you realize very quickly that they're basically just playing motivational musical chairs with all the main characters, and any development, any themes that were already playing into their character arcs are suddenly kind of dashed away, because they just felt like, oh, maybe we can throw this theme onto this character, or this theme onto this character this season. And it made very little sense because of that. Theme is a good thing, but as we've kind of alluded to several times in here, and Benji's even outright called, you kind of have to be careful with it, though, too. In the wrong dosages, in the wrong places, it can definitely bog a thing down, and people will pick up on that a lot quicker than you think they will.
I think the easiest way to phrase it might just be theme for its own sake. You know, theme, I feel like, is something we find in a piece rather than impose over it necessarily. Although, right. Take that with a grain of salt.
Well, I mean, that's kind of true, though, because that's what separates it sort of from just a straight up moral, right? You get to the end of a fable and they lay it out. This is what you should have learned from this. And it's, while I personally love fables, old school ones, they do kind of have their own place, though. And you seek that moral at the end of them because that's part of the medium. But in the stuff that we have today, we're, I struggle to call it nuance, because let's face it, in mass media, there's not a whole lot of nuance out there per se, but it is kind of a little bit more nuanced now, though, where you kind of enjoy digging for that theme a little bit. You don't, most of the time you don't have to dig very deep, but sometimes you do, and it's kind of rewarding in its own right to find it in there.
I want to go back just real quick to what I believe it was Benji said about the cartoons from the youth. Was it Benji or?
Yeah.
The cartoons from his youth compared to the later ones. Part of that, I really think, is to do with the approach to arcs in general. Because when, you know, Tom and Jerry was written in 60s, 70s, and then did reruns forever, they were looking at these really short episodes that would be shown out of order. So they, you know, you'd see it mm-hmm. whenever you could see it, and then it'd be in syndication. It's all out of order, so you could never have a cohesive storyline or anything developing over the course of any length of time other than 15 to 20 minutes. And so the approach was really different, and that's why you have these sitcoms really being the stars of the shows, and the dramas were very much dramas within a 30-minute format or 50-minute format, not over the course of a season. And that was really relegated to soap operas. You know, if you have, or either that or miniseries. If you have something developing over multiple series or multiple shows, then you're either going to be a soap opera or a miniseries. And soap operas had a lot of negative stuff associated with it. And so it wasn't until you started seeing cable being able to be streamed that you really saw these shows able to carry things over. You know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was the one that really caught my attention. I'm not sure if it's the first one that existed like this in the media, but when they kind of made that shift from Monster of the Week format to season-long storylines, that was a big paradigm shift that got copied in a lot of places. And now we see it all the time in cartoons.
Well, and so... So the interesting thing is I can actually point out to you where I think that the transition happened in history. I just had to Google this just to double check myself, fact check myself as best I can here real quick. But to me, and it always has been, this is another soapbox of mine, not just on the podcast, but kind of in real life. The best show ever to happen was Batman the Animated Series. I feel like that changed the ground of the television world a ton, and not just for animated things. They showed that kids could handle darker themes and topics and just a darker aesthetic, but it also kind of changed the way that we kind of consume television, and you get a lot of shows that pop up after that point, like Buffy, for instance, that suddenly said that, yeah, we can do all these fun character arcs and things when we realize that television is coming at us in a stream, like you said. You get a lot of stuff that kind of evolves out of that. Even looking back at things like Courage the Cowardly Dog, you get stuff like that where every episode is kind of like an episode of The Twilight Zone. I've always told people it's basically Twilight Zone for kids, where there's a lot of weird stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff that happens in the episode, but there's always weirdly some sort of takeaway at the end. I guess I shouldn't say always. There are a few episodes in there where it's like, well, it was just a fun one. But you get these messages and things that come along through there. You often, again, have to dig for them. But, I mean, even shows like that, which were quick and digestible, kind of became their own thing now where we thought, yeah, we can do this. We can put these themes in here. That didn't really belong anywhere at the time, except for in soap operas, right? Where you had the ability to experiment a bit more with the time that you had.
Yeah, and I feel like this is sort of a thing that happened, that this sort of thing where a medium or a genre that's been previously relegated to sort of one-shots and, well, not one-shots, like Monster of the Week style, or very unrelated things, can branch out. And I think that's sort of a thing that I'm pretty sure it happened a bit with serialized stories back long ago, but more recently, and I'm going to out myself as a massive nerd and incredibly uncool now, it's happened
what?
With
we don't
Minecraft
have nerds here.
Yeah.
What?
It's happened with Minecraft YouTube series, in that over the past few years it's gone from what used to be quite an episodic sort of not very serious, not very theme densely, into some incredibly like deep, thought-provoking stuff done through the medium of Minecraft videos on the internet, which I know sounds a bit strange, but trust me, I think it's interesting that that new, very different medium also opens up to new themes. Like, you can have a whole lot more interest playing with narrators if you've got, like, 10 people all recording their part of the story, how they see it. I think you can play with a lot of themes of, like, who's in the right and more, like, ideas of greyness in that way. And I think yeah, theme is in some ways linked to its medium, and as a medium gets sort of recognized as more it as possible to do these larger things in it and to delve deeper, like you said, with animated shows, then you'll be able to increase, like, you'll be able to get deeper things and eventually, like, bring more interesting things out, and you can exploit your new genre however you want, like with the shows before, where before you couldn't really do much in the space of 20 minutes, but now you can do a whole lot within weeks of within weeks of hour long or weeks of a show, sorry, and you can sort of spread it out and delve into things, and you can just do a whole lot more with that show sort of medium that you couldn't right. do in others.
This is totally tangential, but you were talking about Minecraft and storytelling in it, and like it as a medium, and like I'm not deeply involved in the Minecraft community, but like from the outside, this is like a side note, maybe something to talk about on like a future episode, but my God, it is like such an interesting paracosmic space, because it's a reality wherein like new stories and experiences are being told and crafted, and people are like invested in it, and it's like the way we play D&D, we accept a lot of things about the conventionality of the genre. We know people are going to do magic and things like that. There will be humanoid races. It's a secondary world that is not maybe in our, you know, our cosmos. And Minecraft, to me, is like, it's like that, but like something completely different, where people are like box-shaped and the world is voxel, and you can craft so easily anything, and like it's just it's a weird emergent space that people are really creating in. And I think a lot of us, you know, older millennials, well, I guess I'm not an older millennial, but a lot of older millennials and in that group who like didn't necessarily grow up with Minecraft as a culture see it and don't understand it the way maybe the previous generation wouldn't understand D&D. So total tangent, but it's just really interesting to hear you talking about it as a medium for storytelling like this, because, you know, I think so many people would miss that.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about storytelling in Minecraft, and I don't think most of them probably shouldn't be on this podcast, which is about themes, not storytelling in Minecraft.
Yeah, total tangent. But
so we've really covered the ground largely on you know, these larger, loftier ideas of themes. I guess I've got a quick thought about too, about where we should put themes in a smaller aspect, since we're talking about TV shows, talking about time. Does theme always have to be something that's overarching, or do you guys think that it is something that can be developed sort of in a vacuum of its own?
I have a thought on this. I was thinking about this as we were talking about these more bite-sized experiences that have themes. In a story where you have divisions, you'll have, you know, a chapter, or, I mean, if you're Terry Pratchett, you'll just have a page break or whatever. You'll have scenes. And I think in every scene, you have, like, a bit of theme. Or in every chapter, you have a bit of theme. And there's like the broad theme over the course of the story. But I really think in any situation where there are multiple moving parts, multiple elements, at the end of it, you kind of grasp all of those things and how they interact and how they overlap. And you have some impression. And I think that is actually, on a small scale, a matter of theme. I think the characters mm-hmm. you choose to put into a scene, the way you choose to create the tone for the scene with the weather and the aesthetics and the environment and the way people are talking, all come together to create theming for the scene. And I think when it comes to that small scale, people tend to refer to this more as tone. But I think tone is like its own individual component of theme. So really, I think there's a lot more you can look at in a small space as a matter of theme.
Especially if we're dealing with world building as opposed to narrative themes, then the smaller the space, the more crucial a focus on a clear theme is. Because if we are talking about a short story or a 15-minute video or something like that, where we're trying to build a world in a small space, then you just don't have a lot of extra room to kind of go in a lot of different directions without making it cohesive. You need to be on point, whatever that point is.
Yeah, we actually have some notes here on it that I've forgotten what I even put down, but I mean, I think it's a really interesting thing to like realize. Theme is not just a storytelling concept. Like I said earlier, you have web pages with themes, right? And so for world building, mm-hmm. I think it's important to remember that your world can be themed as well. And I think Kathy, you were talking about this earlier, how having like an informed decision about the theme of your story, you know, might be difficult and might restrict you a bit, and you might have to kill some darlings. But like with the world, I think it's a little more useful to have that guidance because you have such a huge project that you're working with. Having an idea of what the world is going to be about, why you're exploring it, what matters about this world, what elements of it you want to put forward, keeps you from, you know, my analogy I always use, keeps you from trying to detail the wings on every beetle in every field or come up with the genus of every blade of grass, which you could do. But a theme is the kind of thing that would, you know, tell you what to avoid and what to include. I think one of the difficult things about world building is you do have that kind of like mechanical imperative. You have causality and happenstance and the universe doing its thing and rocks forming in space and the way sun shines on the planet and all this stuff. But it's easy to forget that you're God and you can absolutely eschew any number of those things. It's a secondary fantasy world. The question is, why? Why would you eschew any one and not the other? And I really do think that comes down to theme. One example I have of this is George R.R. Martin. The presence of magic in this world is a huge thematic element, and it's tied to dragons, the existence of them, the lifespan. When dragons died, the magic kind of tapered off and went out of the world. With the dragons reemerging, magic is kind of coming back. And he didn't have to do that. He didn't have to tether magic to dragons. He didn't necessarily have to include dragons, but it's like this iconic part of magic and myth. And it thematically makes a lot of sense. And so we kind of have this like reference point for the change that's happening. And I think it's one of the things that makes that theme so powerful in A Song of Ice and Fire.
I think another thing that world builders need to keep in mind, and is really hard sometimes, especially for world builders who are kind of new to the craft, is that you are not building the world in your mind as the final product. You're building the world in the audience's mind, and you only have so much say on what actually goes on in their head. And so when you are building this world, what you're trying to do is create these touchstone experiences and illusions that can draw on things that are already in their head. Because if you try to literally say everything in the world, it's just too much. They're not gonna want to read it, or they're not gonna want to sit through it, and they're never gonna remember it. And so you need things to tie together so you can give them as little detail as possible to have things emerge in their head from the little bits that you put in, like seeds growing a whole plant rather than an encyclopedia that you hand over. So I think that that's another thing to keep in mind when you're doing theming and world building, is that you're not trying to give everything. You're trying to figure out the core of it and then let it grow, crystallize, whatever analogy you want to use, inside their minds. And then you need to let it go and let it be there.
They had a really good analogy for this on I think it was, I can't remember his name, Howard Taylor? I think it was Howard Taylor. Mm-hmm. He was talking about the iceberg effect, where like a good, manageable world building project will look like an iceberg. They'll see the tip of the iceberg and it goes underwater, and you know, that's what they're actually seeing, because they're never going to see the whole world. Mm-hmm. But in fact, all you've done is created a hollow facsimile of an iceberg to look like an iceberg, so that they get the impression there's this huge thing, you know. And right. I think that's great, because yep. that's all we really need in our experience perusing this world, because our imagination does the rest. And I think as an author, it's very easy to forget that aspect of the project, or rather as an artist, it's very easy to forget that half the work exists in the audience's mind.
Well, and especially these days where we are meeting together like this, like world builders and writers, where you get to see these cool things that people have thought out, and you think to yourself, holy smokes, I got to do that for everything. Yeah. I mean, just one trip down the world building subreddit and you're like, holy crap, why do I not have an economy that's that well thought out? Holy crap, why don't I have a creature that's that well thought out? And it's those things where it's like, first off, most of these people, I hate to break it to you, if you're one of the people from subreddit who are listening to this, I apologize, but 9 times out of 10, these people are suffering from world building disease. Most of them don't actually produce anything at the end of the day. So their stuff is cool, but if you are looking to tell a story, then yes, you kind of have to be willing to realize that you are going to only ever really have a facsimile of an iceberg. And there's nothing wrong with that either. I think the other funny thing about it, too, is that we always idolize Tolkien and think to ourselves that Tolkien had this just huge, brilliant thing thought out, when really you're like, you have to realize that probably came to him in chunks, to like it does for everybody else. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Except for I'm learning C.S. Lewis at 8 years old had already created a very vast and incredible world with his older brother or younger brother. I can't remember. His brother.
Why would you tell us this?
Oh my gosh, don't get me started. I know, it breaks my heart. I'm like, holy crap, C.S. Lewis is more successful at 8 years old than I am at, you know, 26.
Have any of you ever read the History of the Middle-earth series, which mm-hmm. is edited by Christopher Tolkien from his dad's mm-hmm. notes? And in that, you can see sort of the development of Middle-earth, and where you can see, oh yeah, these are his chunks, and he was sort of trying to weave them together, and I've only read the first 4, but you can definitely see sort of how it all sort of, that he wasn't starting with one, and he started, I think, with, like, in the trenches he was writing about Beren and Luthien, and I think that's the case. And so then from there on, he was just sort of like gradually expanding it. And then I think at some point he's decided, let's incorporate the stories I've been telling my children. And mm-hmm. he put it all in, and he wasn't building it all perfectly. He was just, he started with the languages, like, then gave him a world, and there's definitely points where you can see, oh, he didn't really think about this, but that's fine. Like, he wasn't focusing on that, he was trying to make an epic. Like, for me, sorry if this gets a bit personal, but my world building is very focused on, like, themes of humanity and like how humans and society work, and so I don't have the most robust magic system, I don't have my cosmology all planned out, I don't have an entire new biology, I just go by what is interesting to me and what suits me for the writing, mostly what my special interests are, because I'm autistic. But yeah.
It's a really interesting topic when it comes to world building, because world building unto itself is, you know, we all know this here, obviously, a valid preoccupation. You don't need to have some final product. You don't need to be writing a story or, you know, coming up with a mini series or something like that. You don't need to mm-hmm. be playing D&D. If you want to imagine, go do it, make an art project out of it. Some of my favorite artists of all time will just come up with worlds and OCs just to draw them, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And they'll never be, you know, a print novel or something like that. So I think that's totally valid. And for that stuff, I think maybe there's some discussion of theme, if you want, to hold those little projects together. But I think by and large, we're talking about theme in these larger projects, right? Like, so
right.
When you are thinking about making an entire world setting, or when you are thinking about writing a novel and it needs a setting, I think it's worth asking, like, am I including stuff in this just because it logically follows? Is this stuff that I'm just doing because this is what you do, either in this genre or in this part of world history or geology or whatever? Or is this something I'm doing because I have some intention to? Is this something that contributes to my vision of this larger project? So I see a lot of fantasy worlds, for instance, that look like fantasy toy boxes, because people will see Tolkien made this amazing language and Sanderson made these amazing magic systems. And those are the things that, you know, speak to them, that they find so interesting. Mm-hmm. And so they're gravitating toward all these things as a way to make their world interesting and fully fledged. But I feel like for Tolkien and for Sanderson, yeah, those things are awesome. That's fine. But the reason I read Tolkien was definitely not for the language systems. When I read mm-hmm. The Lord of the Rings, I mean, those are things maybe people come back for, become deep fans of it for. But the reason I read through The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings was because I loved the tone of it, honestly. I loved the way Tolkien wrote and explored these worlds, or rather took me through these worlds with these characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the icing, it's what it felt like. These languages and these deep histories, religions, whatever, felt like icing. So if they didn't have them, maybe it wouldn't be as much of a phenomenon as it is today, but I still think it would be beloved.
Well, and I think that's what people need to remember is that it is icing. Icing is a really good word for it. It's equally airy. It's hollow when you really think about it. It's not what you went to Lord of the Rings for. And I think that's why you need to be okay with that. You can't become downtrodden by seeing all the cool stuff that you see on the subreddit or in other people's works. You have to be able to accept that's okay to come later. It's not imperative to your process that stuff comes out before you actually start your work, is kind of what I was trying to get at. And I also should have thrown this caveat in earlier, but I'm not like trying to disparage any of those people on the world building subreddit, because like you said, Benji, some of these people are just artists though, and they're creating something neat and cool, and it results in them having something that looks like an iceberg. Like, holy crap, you know, that's a really cool piece there. And it looks like it's really well thought out, when really they have the stuff that they're presenting to you, and there's stuff that you think exists in the background that doesn't necessarily. And that's okay.
I know my problem tends to be the opposite, where when I'm world building, I create a bunch of things and then I have to go through and do a Marie Kondo and just decide, okay, which things spark joy, you know, and which things are really interesting to read mm-hmm. or really help develop the tone or theme that I'm going for, and which stuff is just there because it would, I think Benji said it, logically follow. You know, this particular place has 9,734 people in it. It would be about 75 miles wide. I mean, that sort of stuff is true in my world, but no one needs to read it. You know, it doesn't add anything to anything. So I have to go create, and then I'm happy, and then I have to go through and just edit like a madwoman, trying to take out stuff that has nothing to, and doing that really helps me figure out what my world is about. And that ends up being the theme of the world. And I found it an incredibly useful process to be able to distill it down to, here's my 2-sentence or 5-sentence summary of the world. This is how I encapsulate it. And once I have that, then I really know how to keep going with the world partway through the process.
I would tentatively disagree about Lord of the Rings icing. I think that there is actually a point to having the things like the song breaks, the linguistic piece. It's to, and it is part of that theme of loss, and a part of the theme of the good things are going away, and it's sort of showing like the beauty of the olden days. And whether or not you think this is a good position to take, it's very effective at showing, making you think, maybe we've lost something nowadays, and or may, and sort of it's very much there to show the beauty of the world, but with the elves in it. And I think also, even in those poems, they convey a little theme. So like with the Tale of Tenuviel, it is sort of that idea of doomed romance and sort of that gets echoed with Aragorn and Arwen. But I guess we're free to disagree with that.
No, I actually agree completely. Right. When I read these books, I mean, something I think about is the I think it's the Song of the Entlives or whatever it's called. That part of the story is one of my favorites, and I do think this story would be worse without it. Kind of the thing I was more thinking of was like the extended lore things, like the deeper histories, like knowing the organization of the Godhead behind Arda and what have you. Like, these are things that kind of come up in the background of the story, and we can find them if we go pursue them and we read like the Silmarillion and stuff. But I do think like the story would hold up without the knowledge of those deeper parts of the lore. But I do think a lot of the decisions Tolkien made about the media from his world to share and the perspectives on his world are very valid and do contribute to the experience I cared about in the story, which is not just, you know, the plot of bringing the ring to the mountain or whatever. It is definitely that the world edging toward something darker and a lost golden past kind of thing.
Right, and again, to continue putting Tolkien on a pedestal, I wasn't trying to disparage there either, but it was definitely a thing, though, where he knew why he was putting those things in, though, and I think you hit the nail right on the head there, Sam, with that. And I'm just saying that you have to be careful going into a new project yourself that you don't think to yourself that you need to make a full-blown iceberg. That's more what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The Lord of the Rings stands on its own without the Silmarillion, but I do love the Silmarillion.
It is fun. It really is. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it, because a lot of people don't. It is fun.
I think the hard part of the Silmarillion for me, total side note, but like I went to a lot of seminary and stuff when I was younger, did a lot of Bible study, and it really bored me. Obviously, you know, important text and all, not disparaging it, but like, I was bored by it. And so when I read the Silmarillion, it's has like a similar vibe, not necessarily a similar writing style, but it has a similar like deep history vibe and very like straightforward organizational vibe of households and godheads and things like that. And so I think the only problem is I start to read it and I'm like, I'm in seminary again.
True, Benji.
Yeah. I'm a massive religious studies nerd, so I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, you definitely have... Right. You have to be the kind of person who enjoys it, for sure. It's not like I'm just... It's not a casual recommend, I guess. yeah. But I do still recommend it. It is neat if you're into that stuff, I should say. So one last note that we have on here that we haven't really hit too much, but I think we're okay to not hit too hard as we're kind of wrapping things up here, is avoiding cliches in theming. This is a thing that we have talked about on several episodes, so that's why I'm feeling like we don't necessarily need to do a deep dive into it, but are there any specific theming cliches that you think that people ought to avoid?
We talked a little bit about them earlier. The themes for their own sake, I feel like, tend to be this way pretty often, where you're just looking for something meaningful to stick in there. It feels like there's an imperative to do that these days. And so that's where you find, like, the power of friendship, the power of love. If you find the power of anything, it tends to be that way. For me, it's not so much that these things themselves are taboo. It's more that the way they're integrated into the story. You can still write a great story about how friendship can impact you, but if it's just dressing, if the story doesn't, if there are not a lot of elements that point to that theme, and then you make some grand statement about it, it's going to look superficial and fake.
I'm reminded of a Twitter post, a tweet. I'm sorry, kids call it tweets these days. I saw in a tweet, I think it was of yours or Tim's, I can't remember. Someone was talking about the Hero of a Thousand Faces and how people are constantly misconstruing that. Just you talking reminded me of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. How it's not a template.
And that's actually an interesting example of finding a theme in a thing as opposed to baking that theme in, which happens. I feel
like. Yeah, because like the way I'm reading The Hero with a Thousand Faces right now for the first time, and something Campbell makes very clear is that this is not like a recommendation for a story to write. Well, he doesn't say that, but he makes very clear that this is just something he's observed in a lot of stories throughout history and throughout a wide variety of cultures. And I feel like it's been mosquitoed, especially by the film industry or the commercial writing industry, where authors say you should follow the hero's journey. It is the story that everyone recognizes. Well, no, I mean, think about like horror, for instance. Horror will very often not have like the return, or the hero will not be proactive in making
a
decision.
You can say that again. A lot of people don't return in horror movies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's like, but these are perfectly valid stories, right. And you wouldn't necessarily want to tell them the way these mythological stories are told. But I could go on for that for a long time. Suffice to say, yeah, that's a really good example of a theme people take for granted and kind of just paste over the top of things because it's powerful and it's what you do.
Yeah, I would question Campbell's idea that these can be found all over world mythology as well, but that's for a different time. And yeah, I think there are no cliched themes. There are cliched ways of doing themes, like having, like with say the power of love, with like that sort of structure of the way that the power of love is shown in like, and I think it can definitely be done in a cliched way, but at its core, themes are, they're just ideas, and with the exception of like moral issues, I don't think there are any objectively bad themes.
It might be useful to also think about theme cliches, not just in the sense of a literary theme, you know, what topics are we going to discuss and how do we explore them within a work, but also in terms of thematic elements in a genre or aesthetic themes, where there are a lot of people who do world building where they are doing the regurgitated Tolkien, like was mentioned earlier, or they're saying, let's do, it's Greek mythology, except this one little tweak.
Oh, yeah.
Those get really cliche, really fast. You know, I'm not sure the best way to recommend avoiding that, other than if you're going to do a genre, I love genre, right? But if you're going to do it, you have to understand what's at that heart and think about what you're trying to do with it. So for example, Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of my favorite examples of really diving into a genre. Although The Mummy, maybe I like even better, not the newer one, but the older one, the medium
Brendan
one.
Fraser's The Mummy.
Brendan Fraser one. Yeah, he's great.
Gosh, work you know, of art,
and,
that movie.
And they were going for a world building sort of environment that's really done. People had been doing B movie versions of them forever, and then those movies just dived in and said, "We're going to live it up and bring all the tropes and all the cliches and all of that, but do it great." And they really did it great. So I don't know. I think with genre, it's very easy to fall into the cliches, but some of the people who embrace them the most often do really great things with it. You just have to, I don't know what the difference is. Do you guys have ideas?
I think one of the interesting things is your willingness to play with them, I think, is kind of the key to what you were saying there. You don't have to get crazy unique with them, with the themes that you're using in order to make it feel fresh, I don't think. And I think The Mummy is a classic example of that. It literally takes pretty much all the stuff that was from like the actual original Mummy, and takes it and puts it in there. But then they say, what are some of the things that we can add on there though, that will make this A, feel a little bit more modern, B, make it a little bit more entertaining, and, you know, but C, also make it stand out as something that doesn't feel like it's just a straight up remake. I think one of the better examples that I'm thinking of on this, weirdly enough, is Frozen. I love that it literally just makes fun of every Disney cliche possible. It kind of throws a lot of that in your face. The sparkling, handsome young guy who you think that they're going to hook up with is actually the villain. The power of love that they're looking for is not one that is between a man and a woman, but between a sister and a sister. It takes all these tropes that we know and love and have come to expect from a Disney movie, and it kind of doesn't quite turn it on its head because they are all still there. But mm-hmm. It instead says, what's a different way that we can look at it? What's a thing that we can turn on there a little bit that'll make it feel like it's something new? While it doesn't quite betray the audience. You still see it, you still feel it, and you're like, well, this is still the thing I love, just with something a little extra put on there.
Yeah, my feeling about cliche in general is that it's never a matter of content, or almost never a matter of content, and almost always a matter of execution. And again,
yes.
Howard Taylor from Writing Excuses put this really well. If someone serves you green beans, you're going to know if it's from a can. But if they prepare it well and they saute it in butter and stuff, it's obviously going to be delicious and different. So same food, different preparation styles. And I love that can mm-hmm. as an experience. You're going to know if it's canned, because really what a lot of these cliches are prepackaged meals. And we don't do anything with them. We don't dress them. We don't, create something, a dish out of them for the audience. We're serving it out of the can, and you can taste the can. And that's usually the problem with these cliched elements. It's just that they are not treated. They are not made delicious in some way. So it's not a problem with the content.
Yeah. And Sam, I see that you mentioned earlier, or at least we're going to mention Star Wars. I will say that that's where the new trilogy falls. It honestly, everything else about it is actually really good. If you look at it piecemeal, the cinematography is good, the music's good, the acting's actually pretty okay. But what really falters is they literally take and copy paste all the themes that they wanted to explore in the earlier movies and do it all over again.
Yeah. So what I was going to explain there was why the prequels are my favorite trilogy of Star Wars. It's because they do the bold thing. They try and examine a theme. I would say that it is hamstrung by some of the other decisions, but it is. but I think that the actual examination of the themes is done pretty well, and it's an interesting theme. And I think that if only they had got someone who's better at sort of dialogue and the like, that it could have been a pretty good examination of that theme of sort of like how autocracy becomes in power.
So when
yeah,
you
the dialogue in there is, I don't like it. It's rough, coarse, irritating. Rough. It's everywhere.
I will say.
So when you're talking about the prequels, do you mean like, so which prequels, the episodes 1, 2, and 3 or like
yeah.
Rogue One or okay. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. I think Rogue One and Solo also have interesting themes, but they do it in somewhat more competently a matter than the original prequels, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of cut you off, Benji. Were you going to say something?
No, nothing at all. I was actually just saying, well, the prequels, I mean, at the very least, they have great action figures.
Yeah, I. The prequels are not my favorite.
Star Wars is fascinating because it, honest to goodness, when you really look at it from its first heyday, it really was plain and simple a story of black and white, which if you ask me is actually one of the few places where you might actually find a cliche theme to some degree, which is why you don't see that anymore. I think we've got an infatuation with the gray all of a sudden because we got thrown that a lot. In the 20th century. But that being said, though, I do think there's something to be said, though, about understanding that there is sometimes a line. And I think, though, that worked very well for Star Wars back in the 70s, was having those themes. They just don't play out as well anymore, and it's a shame they couldn't find something different to do with those.
Yeah, I have to admit, my favorite parts of Star Wars are the parts where they go off the rails a bit and do something interesting with the themes. Like, there's one which I absolutely love, which is Tarkin by James Luceno. It's a Star Wars book, and it's conceived as you're following Grand Moff Tarkin around. It's before A New Hope, and it's in the new canon actually, but it's really interesting that it takes you through the mind of an evil person, like an objectively terrible person, and sort of its themes like how did Tarkin get this way, like how did he get to where he is, and sort of like what makes an evil person like this. And it's absolutely fascinating in how it gets you to sort of sympathize and understand this character who, you know, in the back of your mind is a terrible genocidal maniac, but you don't know, but in some ways it manages to convince you that he's actually the protagonist, and he is in that book. But it's such an interesting way to take the Star Wars' black and white themes and then really delve into it in an interesting way.
So when you were talking about getting into the mind of an evil person, Sam, one of the things I thought of is this web serial called Worm by Wildbow. I don't know if any of y'all have read it or heard of it.
I've heard of it.
Chronically recommended.
It is so good. Oh my God. I have to warn you though, I usually prefer books that are happy with happy endings. And this was just not that.
That's why I'm not reading it.
But it's about a gazillion words, but I couldn't put it down. I couldn't stop reading. You start reading and it's like, oh, this is maybe a little bit hard. I can't stop. And then you're in for the next, 20 novels worth of words. It's a web serial, so I don't know exactly how long it is, but it's god awful long. And it's amazing, but it starts off with this kind of bullied teenage girl in a very gritty, realistic superhero world. There are capes and kind of thing. But early on, she's trying to be a hero, and it doesn't end up going well for her. And so she ends up getting superpowers, and I'm not going to tell you all the details, but it shows this this world from a point of view where you're like, you know what? I can't say that it's good. I can't say that she's good. Like, technically, I guess she's kind of not good, but at the same time, she's very much the protagonist. And it really has you examining what that goodness is in a way that I've rarely seen in other books or movies.
Do you guys have any final thoughts, things that you'd like to share with the audience? This is also a chance for you to plug yourself too.
Yeah, kind of wrap up the theme of this video or this podcast. The main thing I want to point out is that theme has substance. It's not just this abstract concept about what the value of the story is or whatever. Theme is composed of all the things you choose to put into your story, and it kind of emerges from them. On the world building side, that can help you to decide what belongs in your settings so that you don't make the whole entire cosmos, which is impossible. Then on the narrative side, that helps you to try to avoid embedding too much meaning before you understand the story. As a writer, you can accept that the things you're putting in your story fundamentally have some connective tissue. You'll figure that out. That's a part of getting to know your piece. So I think instead of just being like, the vague thing I want to convey is something about friendship or whatever, now you can go, okay, what elements of this story have to do with this? How do they connect? And then see what theme is kind of emerging from the dynamics of the story you want to write. And I think that's a really powerful thing to start to recognize. It's also a really difficult high-level thing. So don't be afraid if it's kind of, elusive to you at the start. Can I make one recommendation really quick before I wrap up my bit on this? So there's a short story by Neil Gaiman called Mouse. It's really, it's nothing special. It's a story about a couple who travels to the States to get an abortion. And meanwhile, the protagonist is dealing with a mouse in their home and trying to find a humane mousetrap for it. Two small stories side by side. Gaiman does not make any discrete connection between the two for us. They're just happening. But you get it by the end when the narrator is all upset about what's going on with this abortion process and also manages to catch and humanely release this mouse. You get something about how the character is processing this. And who knows, maybe even something about the author's perspective. But that is a really fabulous example of how a narrative theme can come together, how it doesn't have to be something you intentionally point to for the audience. It can just be two different elements of story, or even two different stories, running together to show something interesting.
I'm going to have to look that up. I have never heard of it before, but I really like Neil Gaiman.
It's in the book Smoke and Mirrors, by the way.
Okay. My biggest takeaway is that theme should be an area to explore, not something to impose. And so you might have ingredients going in that will be seeds for your theme, but you shouldn't approach it necessarily with the idea that my theme is already developed and I'm going to write a story about it. Maybe some people can make that work, but I really like thinking of it more as a guide to discovery. An area to explore. It's part of the creative process, and then you look back afterwards and see what came out of it.
I think for me, the takeaway is that theme's certainly a thing you should consider, but you shouldn't feel bound by them. But if you're gonna do them, do it seriously, that's a bad word for it, because if you're gonna do themes. Like, there's so much you can do with them that it's worth at least thinking about it for a little bit.
For me, I'd say do yourself a favor, and next time you're watching a show or a movie or reading a book, heck, even looking at a piece of art, I would try to see if you can find a theme in there. But more importantly, see if you can't find ways that they feed that to you. I think you'll come to discover that you're going to find a lot of not force feeding, at least not from the pieces that you like. You're going to find that they are giving it to you in pieces that you can determine for yourself what it is that you're going to extrapolate from that. And I would say try to find some of those devices and things that they do that you like and find a way to work that into whatever it is you're working on. The biggest thing you can do for yourself in this, which is an artistic endeavor, is experiment and find the things that work for you, both as an artist or an author, but also as an audience member. Benji, just one more time to plug your stuff. People can reach you on Twitter, I believe, but you also have got your YouTube channel, your Twitch channel, both of which are under the name Tale Foundry.
Yeah. You can just go to youtube.com/Tale Foundry Show. That's Tale like story. And then you can just go to twitch.tv/Tale Foundry. You can find us there. The YouTube channel is just us breaking down stories we love, finding useful stuff from it, giving it to you as a writer to steal, to use how you want to. And then the Twitch channel, it's a writing group. We get together with a bunch of other amateur writers, and we just read some of their pieces, give a little critique. It's really like a creative writing 121 class during the sharing portion of the class. It's a lot of fun.
Kathy, Sam, ways people can reach out to you if they'd like to, or anything you want to show off?
I'm on the World Building Magazine Discord as Sam the Dragon, and also a bunch of other Discord servers. If you see a Samadraig on the internet, that's probably also me, but I don't want to share too much because, yeah, I'm not very... I haven't done anything for the past 4 months. So, yeah, hopefully I'll do something soon.
For myself, I'm part of World Building Magazine, so I'd say definitely read the next issue. And, I joined a Toastmasters group for role-playing game people, so TTRPGers. Huh. So if anybody's interested, I know they're still accepting new people. It's called Dungeons and Toast. So if you want to stop by dungeonsandtoast.com and get some practice speaking to other people, in a sort of fantasy, science fiction, nerd-friendly environment, then they're more than welcome, or they're more than happy to encourage people to do that. But otherwise, I'm a recluse. Don't reach out to me too much, I guess.
You can reach out to us. We're on the World Building Magazine Discord server. You can also find us at worldcastingpodcast.com now. We've got our own URL. It's quite nice. Leave us some feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, people you think would make great guests like Benji here. Most of this comes about because we got suggestions from you guys. Otherwise, not much more to say than keep on world building. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go.
You've been listening to the Worldcasting Podcast, an affiliate production of World Building Magazine. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can check out our website at worldbuildingmagazine.com, where you can also find links to all of our social media and our Discord server. This episode was edited by Adam Bassett.